All right. I just wanted to make. I had to make a slight change to my title. So instead of commerce, property, and bonheur, instead of commerce, virtue, and bonheur, I'm going to talk about commerce, property, and bonheur. I didn't have time to get to virtue. So, in his Observations sur le Nakaz, his commentary on the instructions provided by Catherine the Great to the legislative commission she convened in 1767 to reform Russian law, Denis Diderot observes that the difficulties of économie politique are so great that in comparison, il n'y a guère de problème de calcul intégral et différentiel qui ne soit plus aisé à résoudre. Even Newton's genius would stumble when confronted by the range and interdependence of the variables that must be considered by the political economist, including the characteristics and productivity of various locales, the kinds of goods they produce and the trading networks in which these goods are exchanged, their currencies, laws, customs, tastes, and finally their mœurs. Political economy requires a panoptic view of the système immense de l'ordre social, just as the science de l'homme public, or statesman, depends on a mastery of the particular affairs of the priest, the soldier, the magistrate, the financier, the merchant, and the farmer. Although a solution rigoureuse, the problems of political economy should remain our goal, Diderot concludes, the complexity of these problems is such that we can only hope, reasonably expect to draw gradually nearer to the solution, while hoping the best from time, education, and even the intervention of God in our favor. Perhaps Diderot's account in the Observations sur le Nakaz of the complexities of economics might help explain some of the divergences in the critical appraisals of his economic views. The standard account of Diderot's economic views is probably that after an early infatuation with the physiocrats, Quesnay and Le Mercier de la Rivière, and the theories of the Economiste concerning the free trade in grains, and after collaborating for a while on the journal Les Éphémérides du Citoyen, Diderot came to reject their, quote, laissez-faire complaisance and capitalist ethos following his encounter with the Abbé Galiani in 1759, and then after witnessing the effects of the grain liberalization policies of the 1760s. Several recent appraisals, however, broadly identify Diderot as a partisan of the liberal view that commerce is the privileged means to promote prosperity within the society and peace in international relations. Thus, responding to Sankar Muthu's 2003 Enlightenment Against Empire, in which Muthu argues that Diderot's critique of noble savagery and his, quote, attendant account of humanity as fundamentally cultural helps ground many aspects of his anti-imperialist political thought, Sunil Anyani argues in his 2013 Hating Empire Properly not only that Diderot is a proponent of a soft or douce colonisation, but that this qualified imperialist apologetics is also grounded in his subscription to what has come somewhat notoriously to be known as the du commerce thesis. As Albert Hirschman first characterized it in his The Passions and Interests, Political Arguments for Capitalism Before Its Triumph, the du commerce thesis represents no less than the liberal view that the byproduct of individuals acting predictably in accordance with their economic interests is the creation of a strong web of interdependence, whereby the expansion of domestic trade creates more cohesive national communities, while foreign trade helps prevent wars between them. In support of this argument, Anyanyi adduces one of Diderot's contributions to the Abbé Raynal's multi-volume anti-imperialist tract and History of Global Commerce, which the full title Matthew helpfully read out. I'll just repeat it. The Histoire philosophique et politique des établissements et du commerce des Européens dans les deux Indes, or the Histoire des deux Indes, or the H2I, if you can get it short. In any case, Anyanyi adduces one of Diderot's contributions to the Histoire des deux Indes, of which Diderot is purported to have contributed up to one-third of the final 1780 edition. Here, in an important passage in which Diderot has denounced the actual history of European imperial depredations in the deux Indes, Diderot imagines an alternative imperial history in which, quote, le commerce s'établit sans trouble entre des hommes qui ont des besoins réciproques et bientôt ils se coutument à regarder comme des amis, comme des frères, ceux qui l'intérêt ou d'autres motifs conduisent dans le contraire. Interest, the motivation to pursue economic gain, seeks out opportunities for commerce, which in turn engender sentiments of friendship or fraternity. Although there is a sexual dimension to this passage on which I will not elaborate here, it is probably reasonable to assume that it would be difficult to find a closer or more succinct expression of Hirschman's du commerce thesis than this, which incidentally is conceived in terms similar to those of Adam Smith only a few years earlier in The Wealth of Nations, for whom the division of labor is famously the slow but necessary consequence of that, quote, propensity in human nature to truck, barter, and exchange one thing for another. For the Diderot of the Histoire des Deux Indes, commerce originates in the disposition of human beings to satisfy their besoins réciproques, or reciprocal needs. By this expression, Diderot implies that human needs are naturally diverse and yet also complementary. A trading partner will be found who possesses what I lack and yet lacks what I possess, such that our exchange will be mutually beneficial. Commerce will establish itself effortlessly, sans trouble, and provide the conditions for public happiness in its heureux effet. How are we to reconcile this optimistic and apparently seamless portrait of commerce with the Diderot of the Apologie de l'Abbé Galiani, or with the skeptical empiricist who appears in the Observations sur le Nakaz? Anoush Tajanian provides one answer to this question in her recent study of representations of commerce in 18th century French political thought. Commerce and its Discontents in 18th century French political thought is the full title of her book. Tajanian argues that in fact both Diderot and Raynal's position on commerce, like that of many other thinkers of the period, is best characterized as one of ambivalence. In her usage, this term signifies something other than the mixed feelings of a conflicted observer. Instead, it denotes, quote, an awareness of commerce's limits, a consciousness of its underbelly, and an acknowledgement of the ease with which its deviant forms manifested themselves while coexisting with gentler ones. For Tajanian, Albert Hirschman's identification of the du commerce thesis as the dominant creed of 18th century political economy overlooks its countervailing critique, at least in the works of its more historically minded exponents, of the various forms of a commerce odieux, including those of slavery, piracy, or monopoly. This position thus allows Tajanian to acknowledge the persistence of a liberal side in Diderot's later economic thought, even as she can bind it structurally to its obverse, the critique of odious or iniquitous forms of exchange. Tajanian substantiates her argument that the ambivalence concerning the benefits of commerce resides even within the mainstream of 18th century political and economic thought, and not solely in the writings of its heretical or outlier figures such as Rousseau, through meticulous readings of the Histoire des Deux Indes as well as a number of Diderot's unpublished economic tracts. Her central contention, it appears to me, is inarguable. Nonetheless, if we remain exclusively within the text of the Histoire des Deux Indes, the violent and exploitative forms of commerce odieux on which Tajanian focuses in her study, slavery, piracy, and monopoly, might be taken to represent only abusive and parasitical forms of exchange, whose elimination could be justified in the name of the spirit of commerce itself, and in the terms of that portrait of consent in which le commerce s'établit sans trouble entre des hommes qui ont des besoins réciproques, et bientôt ils se coutument de regarder comme des amis, comme des frères. If this is the case, however, one might still ask whether a reform to the practice and experience of the abusive forms of commerce, particularly in the imperial space of the so-called Deux Indes, is sufficient to provide what Diderot had earlier termed a solution rigoureuse to the problems of the difficulties of political economy. After all, the passage from the Observations sur le Nakaz suggests that these difficulties are not secondary or accidental, but intrinsic to relations of exchange and their complex variables, agents, and networks. In short, Diderot seems to have something broader in mind here. Rather than his philosophical but often polemical contributions to Raynal's Histoire des Deux Indes, I will hazard to assert that Diderot's fundamental writings on economics remain the Apologie de l'Abbé Galiani, and above all his 1763 Lettre sur le commerce de la librairie. The interest of the Lettre in particular lies in Diderot's historical and empirical reflections on the particularities of the book trade, along with the more theoretical kinds of reflections on property and property rights that reappear in more than one passage in the later Histoire. A key explanation of this difference, no doubt, is Diderot's extensive personal experience as author and editor. As in the Histoire des deux Indes, Diderot in the Lettres is attuned to the potentially odious and melancholic effects of commercial practices. Nonetheless, these effects are here not simply secondary or accidental features of markets, but on the consequence, the direct effects of an unregulated trade in books. This does not mean that Diderot is hostile to commerce in the Lettres. As he observes, to blame quelques institutions humaines parce qu'elles n'est pas d'une bonté générale et absolue, c'est exiger qu'elles soient divines, vouloir être plus habile que la Providence qui se contente de balancer les biens par les maux. Instead, Diderot's point is that left to itself, an unregulated trade in books will be simultaneously both doux and odieux. In short, the ambivalence of commerce is constitutive, and the objective of market regulation is to preserve the benefits of markets as much as possible, while eliminating as much as possible their inevitable costs. Much of the Lettres sur le commerce de la librairie takes up what Diderot views as the confusion between privilège and the property rights of authors and editors. Diderot explains that the exclusive privilège to publish a work derived from the first days of printing, when the majority of printed works were originally manuscripts in what we would call today the public domain, and where the justification for the privilège was simply that it permitted an editor, for a limited time, to recoup the costs involved in the preparation and collation of these manuscripts. Originating as a temporary, albeit renewable right to print and sell public domain works, the concept of the privilège was nonetheless transferred to the domain of original works, where its temporary nature was no longer sufficient to defray the additional costs and risks involved in acquiring such works from the authors, as well as in editing and producing them. At the same time, however, due to the misapprehension of the difference between original and public domain works, the privilege came under increasing attack as an unfair monopoly. Considered to be an iniquitous limitation of the freedom of trade by the majority of its opponents, Diderot aims to show, on the contrary, that the privilege system is not strong enough as a regulatory framework for the trade in original works. What is most relevant for us in this discussion is Diderot's analysis of the consequences of an unregulated commerce. The defenders of a free trade in books argue its benefits in terms of a reduction of costs to the consumer, aux besoins du public, au plus bas prix de la main d'œuvre, au moindre profit du libraire. But if Diderot is willing to concede that in theory, la concurrence excite l'émulation, he responds that dans les affaires de commerce et d'intérêt, pour une fois qu'elle excite l'émulation de bien faire, 100 fois c'est celle de faire un moins de frais. The direct consequence of an unregulated book market is a reduction in the quality of published works, since il n'y a rien qui puisse se faire à moins de frais qu'une mauvaise édition. Unregulated markets entail a race to the bottom, the refusal or inability of publishers to make more risky or specialist acquisitions, and eventually to bankruptcies and to the immiseration of the publishing industry. Diderot's argument, in summary, is that even if unregulated market competition is highly productive, dynamic, and efficient, it inevitably tends towards a reduction in the quality of goods and of the rate of profit towards zero at a cost of the sustainability of the system. Unregulated markets might satisfy needs in the short term, but they cannot produce either lasting wealth or the private and public bonheur that may accrue from wealth, the satisfaction of needs, and the value embedded in quality consumer products. There is no invisible hand at work within the market guaranteeing a beneficent outcome. Diderot's defense of property rights in the book trade, droit d'auteur et droit d'édition, is an attempt to provide a remedy for this inconvenience. Although he assumes that they are natural rights and that their enforcement is legitimate on natural right grounds, Diderot does not seem to view property rights as intrinsic or necessary features of markets. Yet, happily, these rights provide a means to prevent some of the deleterious effects of markets when left to themselves. As he observes, si vous préférez une communauté où l'égale médiocrité de tous les membres rend une grande entreprise impossible à une communauté où la richesse soit inégalement distribuée, faites rentrer les effets sans distinction dans une masse commune, j'y consens, mais attendez-vous à ce premier inconvénient et à bien d'autres. Markets that operate in the absence of property rights will produce an égale médiocrité of wealth and will produce goods of equally mediocre quality. Inversely, markets regulated by a regime of property rights will produce better goods and more wealth, albeit wealth distributed unequally. This last point is also crucial to our understanding of Diderot's conception of political economy. There is no triumph of capitalism here in Diderot, or at least no sense that markets should be left to their own devices as the natural mode of human economic activity. For Diderot, economics must always be political, requiring the intervention of the state or sovereign and responding to trade-offs between various interests. The difficulty of political economy discussed in the Nakaz conceivably lies in this inevitable need for market intervention. But regulated commerce nonetheless remains capable of producing heureux effets, albeit at the price of inequality, an inequality which is still preferable to the equal misery that results from commerce when it follows its pente naturelle. It is in this qualified sense, then, that Diderot remains an economic liberal. Thank you.
Thank you.